The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I'd like to start by paying homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So as I was saying at the beginning when I arrived a little bit late, that today is Asala Puja, so it's a very special day. And it's commemorating 2,600 years from when the wheel of Dhamma was first set in motion. And the just reflecting on the story, I think many of you will know the story of the Buddha, how he grew up as a prince or in a wealthy family with all the pleasures he could wish for, and then left that life and practiced high levels of concentration, meditation, until he was as accomplished as one can get in that, and then left that and practiced asceticism, very, very extreme asceticism. So he was constantly on this search for complete freedom and finding the best of what he could find and finding, well, that's not it. And then leaving the ascetic practice to follow the middle way. So he recognized his insight was that the path to liberation is the path between the two extremes of sense desire and like asceticism, or too much, to being too harsh on one's body. And the middle way that he pointed out was the Eightfold Path, which I've spoken about a number of times here already. The path of, it's basically a whole life experience. So right intention, understanding that all things that arise, all things are impermanent. Right thought, thoughts of generosity, goodwill and compassion. Right speech, speech that is honest and kindly clear. Right action, right action is living within the five precepts, living in an ethical way. Right livelihood, making one's living in a way that's not causing harm to others, or at least intentionally causing harm to others. Right effort, the effort to abandon what is unwholesome in our minds and in our lives, to avoid cultivating more unwholesome, and to develop what is wholesome in our lives, and to cultivate that, so to increase the wholesome. And right mindfulness, right concentration, right mindfulness, right concentration. So that it's sometimes when things are put in a list like this, you kind of think, oh God, another list, you know, the Buddha, all these lists, all these numbers. And but the Eightfold Path, it's actually about living. It's about bringing the practice into our daily life. And you know, when I was reading the Dhammacakka Sutta, reading through that earlier today, you know, it's kind of striking how different the Buddha's life was from the life of most of us now. You know, that he was kind of living as an ascetic, and then, you know, as a wandering renunciant, and had the opportunity to explore these different ways of practice, and had come to his own realization through great effort, had come to his own realization. And, you know, then after some hesitation about sharing, whether he would share that with others or not, deciding to teach. And actually the first teaching he gave was before the Dhammacakka Sutta, which is after his enlightenment. He was walking, looking for these five ascetics that he'd practiced with in the forest, and he met a man on the road who was just very in awe of his presence. He recognized, well, this man was walking along, another kind of renunciant, a seeker. And he thought, wow, who is this? You know, he looks so radiant and so brilliant. And asked him, you know, who are you? Who's your teacher? And the Buddha said, I have no teacher. I am the perfectly enlightened one. I am the knower of the worlds. You know, I am the Buddha. I'm not sure of his exact words. I am awake, that's part of it. He said a number of things, I am awake. And the man looked at him and said, oh really? Good for you. And went off in another street, left him to it. So the Buddha realized, well, that doesn't work very well. Maybe I need to come up with some kind of formula. So the formula he came up with was the formula of the Four Noble Truths. The Noble Truth of suffering, its cause, the cessation of suffering, and the path leading to the cessation of suffering, which is the Noble Eightfold Path. So this is kind of like a formula which can be applied to experience. And he found these five ascetics and he taught them this formula of how to understand, you know, suffering and its cause and its cessation. And out of those five, one understood. One of them got it, and that was Kondanya. And he understood everything that arises passes away. Very simple insight. And the veils of delusion were cleared from his eyes to the point that he was a stream enterer. So he saw clearly for a few moments the truth of the way things are, completely and utterly, with his very being saw the truth of the way things are. And so he was the first to actually understand the teaching. And so that's known as the setting in motion the wheel of Dhamma. So, you know, as I was reading this story, in one way it's very uplifting and accessible. In another way, there's a sense of like, well, it's the whole kind of scene there is so different from how we live. So, you know, how does this, what is relevant in our lives? You know, how do we apply? You know, we haven't been practicing asceticism in the forest or probably for years on end, or, you know, having years of practice with, you know, high jhana specialists. You know, people live their daily lives, and there are many challenges, and you know, you have maybe once or twice a week, if you're lucky, you might be able to come to a group and practice, but it's not the same. There aren't the same kind of conditions. And if we think in the way of, you know, if we think in the way of putting well, it's important to have respect for the teachers, particularly for the Buddha. But if we put the Buddha too high up, then it becomes somebody you can, you know, maybe worship or, you know, remember, and, you know, it can be an inspiring image. But then, how do we get from our ordinary life to what the Buddha is pointing to enlightenment? So as I was reading reading through again, there's the story of the first turning of the wheel of Dhamma. You know, the insight of Kondanya was very, very simple. All that arises passes away. Everything that has a beginning has an end. So it's a very, very simple teaching. And this is what he saw directly. So, you know, different people have different propensities and have a tendency to see the Dhamma in different ways. And for Kondanya, his natural inclination was to notice impermanence. For some it might be to really understand the experience of no self. For others it would be understanding dukkha, understanding the constantly seeking happiness and how this can't really be fulfilled in an ever-changing world. So, you know, it's a very simple teaching, and you might think, well, I know that, you know, everything that has a beginning has an end. Of course it does. But, you know, we know it intellectually, but how is it to really, really know that? You know, how often, I mean, I certainly know it, something I reflect on all the time, and yet, again and again, during a day, there will be the experience of becoming somebody, of grasping that sense of self, and of experiencing suffering through that. And then if I bring mindfulness to that, then there can be a falling away. But I notice again and again it might be resistance. It might be feeling like, I don't want to have to deal with that now. And, you know, I'm actually resisting what's happening. I'm resisting the experience that is happening at this moment. Or I don't want to talk to that person, find them a bit overwhelming, you know. And rather than actually recognizing, okay, right here, this is the situation right now, and opening to it, meeting it, receiving it, letting it pass through this experience of being and change. You know, when we really, really know impermanence, then we can meet every experience in this way. But what I notice in myself, and you might be further on than me, but what I notice in myself is I'll meet experience with maybe attraction and interest and wanting more, or resistance and aversion quite often. So, you know, it's learning to recognize when we're doing that, to recognize when we're, you know, again and again. It might be in a relationship that you're, you know, with a work colleague or something, it's happening again and again, the same old pattern. And in your mind you created them as that person who's like that, who does that to me. And if it wasn't for them, my life would be okay. If it wasn't for that person, the work would be fine, you know. Actually, when you notice yourself doing that, because it's something that the mind does, you can know that's like a classic indicator that you need to turn that attention back towards yourself and see, how is it that I'm creating suffering here in this situation? So, you know, usually when we look, we find either we're wanting or not wanting. We want to have more, or better, or longer, or want it to last forever, or we want it to go away, or we want it to have never happened. We don't have anything to do with it. And it's those mind states, it's those senses, it's that attachment to a sense of self that needs more or needs to get rid of, that is our cause of suffering. That is the very root of the problem. And when we understand that everything that arises passes away, we don't have to do that. It's kind of very, very simple, but it's not that easy to do. But when we understand, you know, if you can just bring to mind in a situation, it's particularly good if it's something that happens repeatedly, a dynamic that keeps going on again and again in your life. And then instead of just doing the same old thing again and again that you've done a million times and feeling resentful for that person out there or that situation out there, just to bring to mind everything that arises passes away and is not self also. So what if I meet this situation? What if I just try a different tack, you know? What if I, instead of resisting and feeling averse, I open, take a breath and open to this person and just be completely receptive to them for this time. Doesn't mean you have to do it forever. Just for this time, what if I do that and see what happens? And even if they are really awful and they really are giving you a hard time, it's not going to last forever. So you're in contact with them for that time and you feel that painful feeling, that maybe anger, aversion, whatever it is, fear maybe. You know, how is it to just stay really present with that? And feel it and let it pass through. And then, you know, at some point that contact is going to change. They'll walk out the room, or Or maybe your opening and your presence will actually change the way they meet you. That can also be true. Because sometimes people hammer away at you because they want you to open. They want to be received, and you're constantly going, it's that person again. But actually, if you just try it once, turning towards them consciously, being grounded, turning towards them opening, receiving, listening, responding, not from the habit, but from a place of presence, and just to see, well, what happens, you know? Is it going to kill me to do that? If it is going to kill you, then don't do it. But if it isn't, you know, just experiment a bit. Or if it's something that you really want, you know. And it's particularly if it's something you really want that you've had a million times already and you want it again. You know, it's just good to have a look, experiment with it. You know, what is it like to just give this up this time? And then you feel the wanting, and, you know, the sense of, you know, mind can come up with all kinds of things, all kinds of reasons why you really must have it, and you might never have it again, and oh my God, I'm missing the opportunity, you know, all of that going on, and then just listening to that and letting it go on, and watching when it ceases, it'll die down at some point, and then saying, well, what's left when that finishes, what's left? Kind of peaceful. It's kind of peaceful when the wanting stops. It's nice. But when we always feed the wanting, then, you know, this is how addiction happens. We are all addicted to something. We're addicted to the sense world, you know, and as the more we feed it, the more we want. The more we have those little pleasures, those little gratifications, the more we want. So it's learning to, and it's not to say that you can't ever follow your desires, you know, you can. There are many sort of innocent, you know, wanting a strawberry or something. It's not going to do any harm to anybody. You know, there are many innocent wishes, but, you know, just to learn what is it like to consciously not follow that, not to follow it because you can't have it. That's something else again, but just to decide to let that go this time, and to, instead of having that sense experience, have the experience of, be with the experience of wanting. Be with all of the clamour of thoughts of as to why you really must have it, and let that have its lifespan and then cease. And then be with that experience after it's ceased, when the wanting has stopped, even if it's just for a moment, to be with that feeling. Because I think that's a very important place that we often overlook, that place when the wanting has stopped, or when the fear has stopped, or when the aversion has stopped. I think we often don't pay attention to that experience, and then we go on to the next thing because it's not interesting enough. It's actually kind of peaceful. It's actually what we're looking for all the time, but it's subtle, so we easily overlook it. So just to see if you can bring attention to the wanting or the not wanting, and then being with that, watching it go through its process and coming to its natural end, and then stay with it, stay with the feeling. And then you maybe notice the next thing that comes up, if you've got very good mindfulness, you might notice the next desire arising. Often we don't notice it. Often we're already right in the throes of it before we really notice what's going on. But, you know, as you develop mindfulness, then you do get to see more clearly the way the mind is working. And the more clearly we see, then the more freedom we have, just naturally. We're not bound by our desires and our fears, which come from a solid sense of self. It comes from a sense of me and mine. I need this. I don't want that. That's where it comes from. So, you know, as long as we're still operating within this sense of self, and as long as we're not enlightened, you know, we do need to use discernment. So it isn't just a passive path. And you know, there are certainly situations where it's right to say, no, this is not all right. And there are situations where it's right to follow, where the heart knows this is the right thing for me to do and to follow that. So we have to use our wisdom, intuition and discriminative wisdom, and get to know that and to trust that. And you know, we get to know that through kind of trial and error. So to get to know our own wisdom. And you know, this really is the path to liberation. It's the path to freedom, and it is very simple. It's remarkably simple, and it's very, very easy to forget, particularly in the heat of the moment. It's very easy to forget. So I just to bring this up again. I think I probably talk about the same thing every time I come here, but I just bring this up again as a reminder, because it is so easy to forget. I say that as a Buddhist nun. I've been a Buddhist nun for about 20 years now, almost. And I can say it's very easy to forget, again and again and again. And it's definitely easier, it feels, on the short term, it's easier to follow the familiar way of relating than it is to take the risk of changing the way you relate to the world. On the short term, it seems much easier to do that. And on the long term, it keeps us caught. We never get off. So there's the wheel of Dhamma, which takes you to freedom, and then there's a wheel of Samsara that keeps you perpetually caught. So following our habitual ways of doing things, this is what keeps us caught on the wheel of Samsara. Birth, aging and death, birth, aging and death, birth, aging and death. And that doesn't necessarily have to be over physical lifetimes, but you can just watch it going on within a day, within a week, within a year, within a lifetime. You can watch those cycles go on and on and on, again and again and again. Those same old habitual ways of responding and reacting. So with mindfulness we have a chance to change that. We have an opportunity to respond with wisdom rather than react or respond compulsively. So this is the blessing really of mindfulness practice. So it's kind of a risk, you know. It feels like a risk, at least, to not follow what we know. It feels much safer to follow what we know than what we don't know. But you know, if we do only follow what we know, we just stay going round and round in a little circle. Whereas if we take the risk to follow what we don't know, or we're not familiar with, you know, to step out of our comfort zones and to respond to a situation in a new way, you know, we might find that it brings, in the short term it might be very stressful, it could be very, very scary, or it might be quite liberating, but in the long run it certainly will be, it will bring increased freedom. So I remember when I was getting ready to, when I was sewing my brown robes, when I was getting ready to ordain, and the senior monk in Amravati at that time was Ajahn Viradhammo, who's now the senior monk at Tisserand Monastery in Canada. And I remember he came in once when myself and the other sister were sewing, and he said to us, did you know that when in India, I think also in Africa, when they capture wild elephants, baby elephants, they often capture a mother with a baby. And when they have a baby elephant, the wild elephant, and they're training it, they tie it. The first thing they do is they tie a rope around its neck, and then they tie it to a strong sapling, little tree that's bendy. And then the young elephant is tied to this sapling, and it pulls, and it tries to get away, but it can't, and the sapling just moves with the elephant. So however hard it tries, it can't break away. And then that's the first step, and then gradually the elephant trainers train the elephant to trust the trainer, and then train it to whatever they train it to do. Actually, I'm not sure. I think they often training for them for work, and also for the, I think in the old days they also used to ride elephants in war, so they would have to train the elephant to remain calm even in loud noises, you know, great challenges, that the elephant wouldn't just kind of go wild, but its mind would still be under control. It wouldn't be frightened and reactive. And then he said, when the elephant grows up and becomes a huge, great elephant, if you tie it to a sapling, it will believe that it can't get free. So even it could just go and pull that sapling out of the ground, because it learnt when it was little elephant that the sapling will hold it however hard it tries. Even when it's a fully grown elephant and can move great big tree trunks, it will believe that it's stuck by that little sapling. So, you know, this is what we do with our minds. We learn a certain way of doing things, we learn certain limitations, and then we think, and maybe we learnt them when we were little kids, and then we think for the rest of our life, oh, I can't do that because that's too big for me, or I can't turn towards this situation because it's too frightening, or I can't do without that because I really need it. You know, that's what we do. It's like the sapling that we're tied to that never gives us that freedom and strength. So I would like to encourage everyone just to explore a little bit around that area and to see, you know, how is it to face what we think we can't face, and to give up what we think we can't give up. Just a little bit, you know, don't make it too big. Well, you can if you want to, but it might, you know, you might be, if you try something too big, then you say, oh no, I really can't do it. So if you feel like that, just try little things. A little thing that you think you need. Or one thing, particularly, I think it's particularly good in relationship, you know, something that you really think you don't want to open to, or you can't face. As long as it's not a very, you know, if it's a very, very abusive situation, then don't, you know, just take care, don't go straight there. But to start with something that's just kind of maybe irritating or awkward or you're just averse to, and just see what it's like to relate in a completely new way and see what happens. And don't just do it once, but do it again and again. Because if you do it once and you know you can do it, then just do it again and again. And don't do it with a wish that, okay, I'll do this so that they change. Don't do it like that either. But just do it because it's what life is presenting you with. And, you know, what life is presenting you with is what is here to learn from, always. So knowing, you know, that like taking refuge in the Dhamma is knowing that everything that arises passes away and is not self. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we can take refuge in that, you know. If we believe that we are, you know, it's always going to be like this, or we really do have to, then we're fully identifying ourselves as a fixed entity. So it's learning to look at our experience in a new way, as a process. Because that's actually what it is. It's a process. It's always been a process. Always. And it will continue to be a process. I won't even say until, because there is no until. So, you know, we think ourselves into solidity, into absoluteness, into, you know, selfhood. We think ourselves into that thought that takes us there. And when we put our mind in the right place, we can start to unravel those knots, or start to dissolve that sense of fixed being. And that doesn't make us into a kind of a wishy-washy, you know, groundless. It doesn't. That's that. Yeah, we might think, the thinking mind might think that, because the ego is very, very committed. You know, it's very important to the ego to find ways to keep this sense of separate self going. So if we just think about it, we might think, oh, I don't want to do that, you know, then I'm going to just be a doormat, or then I'm just going to be kind of like a leaf in the wind. That's what the thinking mind thinks, but actually the experience isn't like that at all, because we're grounded in the present moment. We're meeting the present moment as it is, responding, letting go. And there's no greater safety actually than that. It is the most powerful place to be and the most safe place to be. So at the end of that chant we did, this chant we did in the beginning is basically going through the Eightfold Path. And then the last verse says, they who live by following this path know victory wherever they go, and every place for them is safe. These are the highest blessings. So, you know, this is about being fully present and responding to life in a wholesome, skillful, wise and compassionate way. So we can do it a moment at a time, you know. We don't have to try and make ourselves into being somebody else, or, you know, and we don't have to berate ourselves for the times we don't manage to meet our ideal or rise up to the experiment. But we just recognize, you know, when we can't do it, we recognize, okay, couldn't do it that time. That was too much. And then that's okay, you know, that's also changing. And then there'll be plenty of opportunities. So then just take the next one, no problem. Okay, so I'd like to offer that for your reflection this evening.